Hello, everyone. Welcome to a Friday Fireside Chat. My guest this week is Christian Stadler, who is one of the co-authors of this very interesting book called Open Strategy. And for those of us that are, you know, strategy nerdy people, it's got a lot of real gems in it. There's a foreword by Gary Hamel, who's a legend in the field. And I'm just delighted that Christian's been able to join us for today's conversation about how to, as I read it, include more people in the strategy process and really include more diversity of opinion, include more perspectives, include ecosystem partners. So really creating strategies that are a lot more open to inputs from many. So Christian, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, you know, first of all, thanks for having me, Rita. It's a real pleasure. And we sort of, you know, started to chat. It's always nice to talk to somebody in New York in particular, as this is a place close to my heart, which comes to, I guess, me. I met my wife in New York. And, you know, New York is very special. I live in the UK now, work at the University of Warwick. And like yourself, I'm a strategy professor.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good. But you were telling me that you did your PhD and postdoc at Tuck, was it?
No, actually, PhD was still in Austria, and it was in business history, but I did a postdoc in Tuck then. I spent a couple of years up there in Hanover, New Hampshire, and I still go back. I work with some people there, with Connie Helfert and Albert Taylor on a variety of different projects. I've been teaching early this year up there as well. It's really always nice up there in Tuck.
Oh, Tuck's great. Tuck's great. Our son's a Tuck alum, and and I work with a lot of people, you know, up there. We've done a lot of different projects. Scott Anthony is now an adjunct there from Unisite. So yeah, we've got a lot of connections backwards and forwards. But I thought it would be great to talk about this book. So Open Strategy, and I think the thesis of the book is that conventional strategy making is sort of, the model is, you know, the senior people go up to the mountaintop, they hire a facilitator from a fancy consulting firm or an academic or whatever, and they spend 3 days arguing about the difference between mission and vision. they print the t-shirt, they come down from the mountaintop, and then everybody gets to execute what they have in their, you know, high-level minds decided to do. And your book takes a really different perspective on that. So maybe start off with how this idea came to be something you wanted to write about, and your journey towards achieving that.
So, you know, it's very funny that you ask, because I was almost strong-handled into writing this book by my co-authors. It was a few years back where Stefan, Julia, and Kurt, my co-authors, met in Munich. And Stefan, he's running a consulting company, a small outfit in Germany, who has helped companies to include a larger group of people in strategy making. So they, you know, thought they'd like to write a book. They knew me well. We've worked together for many years on various things. So I thought, you know, I'll be a nice partner in crime for this. But when they talked to me, I thought, what, really? You know, strategy, that is for the bosses. This is for the senior executives to do it. How can you involve a large group of people? Now, I'm glad, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, that I was open-minded enough to explore this a bit further. So, you know, I joined some of those engagements that the consulting company was doing. We started to talk to other companies who have been more open in the strategy making process. We are reading. There's also a sort of small but growing academic literature on this. And Julia, who is one of the co-authors, is very heavily involved on the more hardcore scholarly work in this space. So, you know, with getting engaged in this, more and more, I turned from a skeptic into a prophet of this idea. And, you know, that's where then we started to write this down in the form of a book. I thought it's a tremendous, powerful idea to use the wisdom of a crowd in a very smart way in the strategy making process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I talk about a lot is that the signals, if you will, of the need to take action of some kind are very weak in the early stages, and they're often to be found at the edges of the organization. So involving more people kind of makes sense, because that's where you know, people are there to kind of pick up the signals that something's changing. So in the foreword to the book, Gary Hamel kicks off with an example from Nokia back in the glory days. And I really resonated to that because I was doing a lot of work with Nokia, I would say in the late 90s, yeah, early 2000s. And back in those days, you know, the world of mobile was still kind of a Wild West. It was really unknown. And what Gary talks about is how they used these large group settings, these engaged employee settings, to really set a very ambitious goal for themselves, which was to sell a billion mobile phones, and how they really used these large groups to bring them insights and information. And yet, over time, Nokia seemed to have lost that connection. And I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on that example.
Yeah, so I was not involved with Nokia, but as Gary was telling us, is that eventually those people who were originally opening up, bringing lots of people in, they reached this stage where they seem to have found the model that works. And this is also the stage when they did not include so many people, when they stopped these sort of wide engagements because they had something to defend. And, at one point that business model didn't fit quite so well with the changing world. And we all know what happened eventually with Nokia. Now, would they have been able to avoid this by staying open? I really don't know. You know, we have to be careful whenever you have an idea, then, you know, everything you see seems to fit with this idea. But, you know, it's speculative. I would say the chances would increase if you engage with a larger group of people. But of course, you know, there's no guarantee with that either.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's walk us through how open strategy works. I mean, you got the first, so just I'll show the book again. There we are, open strategy. So the first couple of chapters really look at how you can begin to think about disruption. Well, I guess you start off the book by talking about traditional strategy and how that is less fit for purpose in more and more dynamic environments. So maybe start there.
Yeah. So that's true. And one thing that is really important as well for us is that the implementation side is more integrated into the whole strategy making process if you involve a larger group of people. That's important because the majority of strategies fail, not necessarily because the ideas are wrong, but it sort of doesn't work. Yeah, it could be that when it hits operational front end, people don't understand what it's like. They don't really, you know, see how it fits what they already do. And particularly when sort of this substantial shift in an organization, that can be really tricky. We have this story, which we opened with from Barclays, and I think that highlights that to some extent. This was in 2012, and it was in the retail arm of Barclays in the UK. Now, Barclays is a 300-year-old bank, so lots of traditions and a kind of classic bank, really, does that well. But in 2012, it also started to be clear that the world of banking is going to be more digital and that this will have huge implications. Now, you know, you can go in various ways to pursue or confront this digitalization. And the classic model would be the one that you described in the very beginning, where this very small group of executives go, I'm from Austria, so, you know, the mountaintop is something I can certainly relate to, but some way, you know, reclusive, a small group of very senior executives, maybe with the help of a big consulting company, tackle the issue. But then you have the problem, particularly when it comes to something like a substantial shift into digitalization. How do you bring everyone along? The first thing, if I work in a bank like Barclays and I work behind the counter and I hear digitalization, I'm going to think, what about my job? You know, this is going to go away and I will find ways to somehow, you know, maybe push back, slow it down. I will certainly not be the first and biggest champion of digitalization. Mm-hmm. And Ashok Vaswani, who was in charge of the bank at the time, I think he knows that really well. The way he put it in a conversation I had with him is that strategy is in essence really trying to answer three very simple questions. Where are we at the moment? Where do we want to go? And how we get there? And, you know, it's a simple but really smart way to look at it. The way he puts it then is that everyone in the organization has answers to the to these questions. And why not use them? You know, it's an obvious and smart thing to do, and in particular when it comes to something like digitalization. So how did they do that? Yeah, because one thing is, yeah, it might be a good idea, but how do you really involve 30,000 people? In an early phase, which already, I guess, was larger than usual, where they had different work groups, some of them staffed primarily with young people who were less tainted by the way things have been done in Barclays in the past and sort of fresh ideas. These work groups set out big trajectories. But then in the second stage, they rented out cinemas throughout the United Kingdom and brought really hundreds of people together in this cinema halls, well, thousands actually. And they set up a strategy jam. So that's, you know, you can think about it a little bit like an online conference where people participated in work streams. The work streams were organized along those big trajectories that the work groups had identified. And they kind of, you know, they got into the nitty-gritty stuff of how digitalization will affect them personally, what they can do, how they can adjust things. I liked a lot the story they were sharing with me, where in the mortgage department, somebody noted that Domino's Pizza, that's a big pizza delivery chain, was able to tell you, well, you order your pizza now, we put the ingredients on the pizza, pizza goes in the oven, pizza comes out of the oven, pizza is on the way to you. And in the mortgage department, that person noted then in this jam, we cannot tell any of these things to our customers. We can tell them, hey, you know, mortgage application received. And in the end, we tell them either you get a mortgage under whatever conditions or you don't get a mortgage. But in between, no communication with your customers. And that's just sort of, you know, not in sync with the expectations of customers. If we can get more details about a pizza, really, you know, it's just not right.
I love that example. I absolutely love that example.
It's a nice one, isn't it? So, you know, with this engagement, things got real. And I talked to quite a lot of people in the bank. They were all saying that the vibrance, the sort of, you know, engagement they had, it was unmatched. They never had it before. They never had it after to that extent. And it set up, you know, a flurry of different activities. They set up, some employees set up a group of digital eagles, they call it. Yeah? So those who were more digital savvy started to help those who struggled with this type of stuff. I guess the sort of most measurable thing is they set up their first mobile app about, you know, quite shortly after the jam, and almost overnight got 1 million users. Today, 9 million users, and that makes it one of the most successful fintech products in the United Kingdom. That's pretty impressive, you know, for a 300-year-old, slow-moving retail bank. Don't think, you know, this would have been possible if we would have taken this more classic top-down approach. Not so many brains would have moved along with the process. That I think captures really nicely when open strategy is really suitable in which sort of situation and how it helps a company to do something that you could do in a different way, but I think much less successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating also that it's really, you know, it can be facilitated by digital technologies. You can get a lot more voices in. So one of our participants, Frank Kalberg, is asking GlaxoSmithKline releasing clinical trial data to help discovery of new medicines. I mean, this is unheard of, right? I mean, and I think partly this is also a consequence of the pandemic, where a lot of really unprecedented levels of cooperation we saw in pharma and other industries where people were really sharing with each other. And he's wondering if you know of other pharmaceutical companies doing something similar.
So the short answer is no, I'm not sure. Yeah. But I think one thing he points out here is that stuff that used to be really secretive and companies thought, oh, I can never share that. Yeah. Is starting to get more out into the open. And an example that I found really interesting and probably sort of on the extreme fringe is the US Navy was actually opening up their thinking. They wanted to, you know, engage through, it was an online game type setting where participants were starting to come up with ideas of what the future will look like for the US Navy, what sort of, you know, things will matter. They've done smaller exercises before. One of the experiments was around, well, you know, how the threat around pirates in the Somali area would affect the Navy and what people could do about this. But now with this sort of broad engagement, what I found interesting, so they went through that and they also published a report with all input that they got. What they did not publish is what they're doing with this information. So, you know, you can still, you know, you engage a lot of people. And, you know, there were concerns by some people, particularly from the legal side within the Navy, to do that because they were worried, what about, you know, future procurement processes? Will somebody be able to claim that, that then, you know, you get an unfair advantage by being involved in that process? But the admiral in charge just put his foot down, yeah, and he decided to take the risk, which he thought was limited in that regards. I'm told, you know, they didn't share exactly what they did afterwards with me either, but what they did tell me is that they started something which is a bit more skunk work like. They haven't done that before, and they're using that information in their sort of preparing for the R&D kind of engagements that they're doing for the next few decades. And that's sort of a vital piece of input they have there.
So if you walk us through like an open strategy process, because I mean, one of the tensions I always find with strategy is, first of all, how do you even define it, right? Yeah. I can share with you my definition. I'd love to hear your definition. And yet there's this, and we've seen many examples of this in you know, in history where, you know, you have a divergence, right, which is, I think, where open strategy, as you define it, fits very well. But then eventually there's a need for convergence. You know, you need to make some decisions, you need to make choices and fundamentally strategies about what are we going to do. But it's also very much about what are we not going to do. And one of the challenges, I think, of having many, many voices involved is everybody thinks their baby is beautiful. Everybody thinks their idea is great. And at some point, someone's got to say, hang on, no, we're doing this. We're not doing that. Right.
So very true. What we do in the book is we have various different tools or instruments, so whichever way you would like to call that. Some of them are digital, or some of them are more traditional workshop type settings. And you know, they're very
for our readers. I mean, the book is just full of little graphs and charts like this, so that you can actually, you know, begin to make it very operational.
Yeah, I think that was our attempt. Yeah. And by having this involvement from the German consultants who have done that for hundreds of clients, it helped. Yeah. To do that. But it's not just what they are doing. You know, we looked far beyond that as well. So coming back, you know, how can you converge actually now? Because we started off digital, maybe, you know, I talk about the digital part first. Yeah. Probably, you know, if you do a very large scale kind of engagement of that I described for Barclays, I would say IBM probably has the best technology to do that. And what they have, they use the Watson computer with various sort of AI techniques to filter out some of the ideas that seem to be particularly prominent. So I'll give you an example again of once they did it in a setting where finding convergence is particularly difficult, and that's policymaking. So in the early days of the COVID pandemic, NATO and the European Union decided that they want to set up a jam where they think about security implications of COVID. And, you know, I talked to the top policymaker in the Pentagon responsible for NATO policy, and he was saying, the way we usually do this, yeah, when we make policy is we come together with our closest friends. Often that is, for the Americans, that's the UK. We discuss what should be done. We find an agreement. We think that's so great that everyone else will cheer on and fall in line. Now, he also added, unfortunately, it turns out that this is never the case. You have so many different interests, yeah. within countries, not just, you know, political interest, but there's industry interest. There's various different lobby groups. There's, you know, in the security area, have different branches, army, navy, etc., which already have different interests. Then, you know, internationally, it becomes more and more complex. So finding consensus is tremendously difficult. So they set up one of those jams, very similar to what Barclays did, and they had 1,800 participants in this, including ministers, very senior policymakers, who were talking about these security implications. And he said, I mean, you can never expect that after this straight away translates into new laws being introduced. But he did notice that there was, for example, a strong consensus that there was a massive threat from China and Russia. And, you know, today that seems to be obvious, but he said back then, this was not so clear for many, many countries. So the UK is one example where they had planned earlier to get the 5G network from Huawei. And, you know, that was, you know, eventually dropped. And it's hard to put your finger on it exactly, but it did lead to more convergence around where these big threats are coming from, he was saying. The digital, you know, tools that they had was, in this particular case, a debater tool, he was saying, where you had the main arguments and pros and cons around certain topics filtered out by machine learning, and this sort of, you know, China and Russia threat came to the top of that list. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's in the digital space. Now, maybe one quick example from the more workshop type setting, where something that helps you to converge is if you set things up a little bit like Dragon's Den, Shark Tank wise, you have competing groups with ideas. They could, you know, create a business model, for example, around the new trajectory that the company wants to pursue. Ideally, you bring outsiders into this process as well. So, you know, 50% from outside the company, 50% inside the company, you create mixed groups, they pitch their ideas, and then you have rounds of voting. Yeah, you get rid of half the ideas, the losers join them with the winning teams, they flesh out more detailed business models, you have another round of voting. That can help with the convergence as well. The final thing is still the leadership. Yeah. So I'm careful. We don't want to turn this into a corporate democracy. And that has to be clear from the beginning. Yeah. That the final decisions do sit with the leadership.
Mm-hmm. So how do you define strategy? Do you have a definition that you enjoy?
You know, you probably read Dick Rommel's book, The Crux. Yeah. And
he's
going to
be on in a couple of weeks.
Oh, it's going to be on in a couple of weeks, yeah. So, you know, he has this really smart way. I think he thinks about strategy as problem solving, where on the one hand, you need to think about what's the biggest and most important challenges you have. And on the other hand, you need to think about how addressable are these challenges for you, which kind of brings you down to your resources and capabilities. And I think these two dimensions are really the right ones for me to think about strategy. So I kind of, you know, like this approach a lot. How about yourself? You know, how do you usually think about strategy?
Oh, me? So I have a definition of strategy that I guess I've been using since I was a PhD student working with Don Hambrick. And I define strategy as a central integrated concept of how we're going to achieve our objectives, which connects to Dick's definition in terms of the crux. I remember being at a conference with Dick Rommel once, and he said to me, he was on the stage and he said, well, you know, I had a friend who came to my strategy class. And after sitting through most of the semester, he said, it strikes me that most of this class is really like, what the hell is going on? Like, that's the core of what we're trying to figure out here. But anyway, when I talk about central, what I mean by that is everybody kind of has an idea that's consistent. So if you pick three people at random from your company and you say, what's our strategy? You get pick an answer that's sort of vaguely consistent. So that's central. Integrated means it all fits together. So if I'm Walmart, right, and my strategy is about everyday low prices and I'm all about optimization and efficiency, then I walk into the waiting room, you know, in corporate headquarters and it's leftover sample chairs from the last vendor that was giving a demonstration, you know, and that's going to be very different than if I'm Tiffany, you know, and I'm all about luxury and whatnot. So integrated, it all has to fit together. It's a concept, right? So part of, I think, what's so interesting about your open strategy notion is that concepts are ideas. You know, it's not like you can drop this thing on your foot and know what it is. It's got to have resonance human brain to human brain. And I think that's really the concept. And then I think good strategies really are about the how. And this, again, is where it connects with Dick's work about the crux, right? What is the central thorny problem we've got to address here? And how are we going to do that? So I think that's, I think that that's how I define it. And
that really resonates with me as well. Yeah.
Oh, very similar, right? So one of our loyal participants, Juan Miguel Robles, is asking, how, in your experience, can companies begin to open up if they're used to being very closed, if they're used to being just not very participative in their strategy making? How do you get them to think a little differently?
So I guess there's a couple of things to consider. First, the personal level, and then the more corporate level. The corporate level is maybe even the easier one. I would pick something that is not the kind of core business, but a smaller, maybe a project, side business, ideally one that faces a lot of disruption, and you experiment a bit. You know, you get to learn how this can be done. It's a German company that produces various sort of, you know, food items, Dr. Oetker, they're called. And do you have them in the States as well, Dr. Oetker?
Okay, I think under a different brand, I think we do. But I remember that growing up because, you know, my parents were German, and we always loved Dr. Oetker. I mean, that was a staple in the pantry, absolutely. Yeah.
So you know, when they wanted to get started, they started with the cereal business. That's a smaller business for them. And once they, you know, felt comfortable and familiar with that, then they moved it to the frozen pizza business. That's the biggest and most substantial business for them. That I think, you know, is how a company should go about this. Start with something smaller, experiment, you can make a few mistakes, and when you feel that works well, you move on to your core business as well, if it's suitable for that. On a personal level, you need to be sort of, you know, ready and buy into this, particularly the leadership. If they don't, it's not going to work. Yeah. And there's a few sort of, you know, things that you can ask yourself to figure out whether you're ready. The first question you can ask yourself is whether you are more of a Miles Davis or more of a Johann Sebastian Bach. And what I mean by that, yeah, is Miles Davis is representative for jazz, sort of more, you know, you will shape things as they move along. You can improvise on the way as well. Whereas Johann Sebastian Bach, one of the greats in the classical music era, is more structured, more predictable. And, you know, if you don't feel comfortable with this unpredictability part, then it will be tricky for you, I think, to feel comfortable with open strategy. The second question that you should ask yourself is whether you're a prince of serendip. This is, you know, this story from these princes from Persia, three princes who go on a quest. And there's all these happy coincidences that happen on the way to that quest. Are you prepared to embrace that? Yeah. Are you fine with not having everything under your control? And, you know, something might just happen, but you give it some airtime, you push it, and you embrace it. Third question you would ask yourself is, are you Adele? And what I mean by that is, you know, Adele, one of these musical greats of our times, we would think, you know, it's all about her voice. It's sort of, you know, about this individual. But really, when you look behind the scenes, she's a massive team player. She has huge groups of people involved, and she acknowledges that. She, you know, makes sure that the best comes out of everyone, and then the overall composition is as substantial as it is. You know, that's something that you need to be comfortable as well, that you hand over responsibilities as well. And that is not an easy thing for many senior executives, because they see strategy making as probably the most important part of their job. So that's hard, yeah? And the final question you ask yourself, do you love pirates? And that comes from NASA. NASA had this group of people who called themselves pirates, and they did all sorts of, you know, wacky things. They created a network of computers at a time when there was a big centralized computer that was manning the flight control system. They were given room to do so, and it turned out to be really substantial. So basically, you know, are you happy with some people not doing what they're being told, allow them to kind of be a bit rebellious? And, you know, eventually with some of those things, it might be really good for your company. If you're uncomfortable with any of these questions, you might be uncomfortable with open strategy as well.
You know, one of the things that comes across very clearly in your book is that the nature of leadership, and I mean, I'm not sure it ever was this way, but, you know, we have this leadership ideal of command and control, right? So, and I always link it to traditional bureaucracy, which is, if you think about the nature of traditional bureaucracy, you had things broken down into pieces, and, you know, back to Adam Smith and making the pin making factory, and that to be efficient, you specialized everything around each individual piece. And then the only place that all the information came together was at the top of the hierarchy. And therefore, that made sense that the leaders at the top of the hierarchy would then tell everybody what to do because they had all the information that wasn't available to anybody else. What your work is really suggesting is flipping that on its head, that actually the information's out there. And I think we see this in a number of different writings and things people are talking about now. But it definitely means that people at the top of the hierarchy have to give up some control. They have to they have to acknowledge they don't have all the information. They have to be willing to say, maybe there's things I need to learn that are coming from the crowd, that are coming from the field. And how have you observed executives managing this? You know, who does it well? Where do they struggle?
Well, you know, some struggle more, some struggle less with this. With the more struggling side, you know, an example in the public view at the moment is probably Elon Musk. Yeah, I don't think he's a big fan of giving up control. He's probably not setting up focus groups to make decisions. Yeah,
so you know, a lot of crowdsourcing of ideas. In fact, I think if I'm right, he's gotten rid of a lot of his crowd.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, I mean that. Who knows, you know, the judgment is out. Maybe it turns out to be hugely successful. Yeah, we don't know. Now, it's not the model that resonates with me. I think some companies have been actually good for decades with sort of a more iterative process and a more engaged one. A company that I know fairly well, I've sat with them while I did my PhD and written about their history as well, as Shell. So I think, you know, Shell scenario planning that goes back to the 70s was in a way a process that reached a lot of people. The core team in itself, I think at some stages was around 70 people or so, you know, at its height. Yeah. And they went out all across the world, did interviews, you know, made engagements. Even at the top level of the leadership, you know, they had this sort of consensus approach to strategy making in Shell that has been, they didn't even have a CEO. That's the interesting thing. Yeah, they had a committee of managing directors, and one person was the spokesperson, but he didn't have the rights that the CEO had. The earliest one I talked to was in charge of Shell in the late 60s. Yeah. And he was clearly reflecting as well that this is sort of, you know, the big decisions, not only were they made collectively on the top, but there were layers from below where what they thought and did filtered through, as well. And, you know, that sort of setting clearly worked well for this organization. It's maybe not quite the same thing as what we talk about today when we talk open strategy. But, you know, that was in an era where other things were super hierarchical. Exxon at the time, they were saying that if you want the new pen, you need to call Houston. You know, it was that centralized for them. And Shell really was the opposite model for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where do you see the process work well, and where do you see companies get in trouble? Like, what are some of the pitfalls to watch out for if you're trying to be more open in your strategy?
Okay, so the first one you already mentioned is the top leadership needs to really be in this. Yeah, for example, Stefan's company wanted a project with an engineering company in Germany, and the CEO was, well, you know, let's give it a shot. Yeah, but then it turned out that the results were not resonating with parts of the organization, and hence, you know, he just sort of, you know, put it away and said, you know, let's forget about it. Yeah, he was simply not sort of enough into this to jump fully on the outcome of that.
Well, and if you think about it, you know, I always tell people, look, if you want to try something along these lines, so whether it's innovation or whether it's open strategy or whatever, you really have to mean it, because the worst thing is to go halfway down the path and then say, oh, well, never mind. And then it just demoralizes people. You know, they feel, you know, you asked me to step up, you asked me to get engaged, I got involved, my emotions are all high, I spent my time on it. And then you basically turned your back on it. And it's almost worse than if you'd never started.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You disappoint people, you annoy them, you disillusion them. That's really the last thing. The other thing you need to do is, I think you need to be upfront about where people have a voice and how this voice will be used as well. So if you create the illusion that in the end we collectively decide what to do, then again you set up people for disappointment. This is typically, you know, input, and it might be that things come up that you do not anticipate and you make some changes. Steelcase, yeah, the furniture producer in the States, they ran a process at the time when they said, no, they're not going to do anything substantial. It's more sort of a communication process. But there was an idea that came out through that process around involving some of their lead customers in the designing of new furniture, not so much because the furniture is better, but because the customers really like it. Small, one department had done that, and then they adopted it more widely. You know, so sometimes new things come out, but no one had the sort of, you know, expectation that this will happen, because it was clear from upfront what will happen. I think one thing you really need to watch out for as well is strong moderation in these processes. You know, if it's online or if it's in a workshop, if you let things go, then people drift to with the World Cup on at the moment. So I can see people quickly talking about the World Cup rather than what's at hand or lunch, you know, the sort of things that people are always concerned about very much. You need somebody who brings people back to focus, yeah, in these conversations. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Yeah, I could imagine that. So how do you deal with, I've got engaged, I'm very passionate, I'm all intrigued, this is wonderful, I feel very strongly about my idea, but that's not what we're going to do. You know, the decision's made, that's not the direction we want to take it. How do you manage that very human part of the emotion?
Well, you know, I think for most people, they never have a chance to be involved. Yeah. So just the fact that they have a voice and that it's acknowledged. Yeah. Some companies have massive sort of online forums where the strategic discussions happen, but people participate without expecting that what they say will be, you know, picked up by the CEO. The fact that the CEO acknowledges, you know, some of them and, you know, just makes a call out in these forums, that's already a big thing for people who maybe once or twice in their career see the CEO in a larger forum, but, you know, the person being called out, that's massive already for many of them. So I wouldn't sort of, you know, over dramatize the fact that not every idea is being picked up, but I think people are generally comfortable about this. And just because they can't voice it, it doesn't mean that they don't have this idea anyway. Yeah. So, you know, otherwise they just sit there frustrated and think no one knows about it. Yeah. At least, you know, they had some airtime, and somebody else, even if it's not the senior leader, might, you know, give you a few likes on this and you feel better on this. I've had a say at least.
So one thing that I find always a challenge in strategy making and more broadly in growth and innovation programs is, how do you justify the budget for doing this, right? I mean, you know, and I have my own thoughts on that, but I'd be very interested in the companies that you studied for the book, yeah. You know, because this is not inexpensive. I mean, you got to rent movie theaters, or and people have spent time, and you know they could be moving widgets around the organization, but instead they're ideating and giving their opinions, and probably post-it notes are flying all over the walls and whatever else it is. How do you get people to say, yes, this is a worthwhile investment?
Okay, I mean, the easiest way, I guess, to say is it works. We did some survey where we, you know, asked executives whether they open up, to what extent, yeah. And we got the feedback that around a third of all strategic initiatives are open, at least to some extent, but is one third of initiatives generate about 50% of the revenues and profits of companies. So, you know, it seems to work. Yeah, that's, I guess, my first indication. Now, how does it work? We also asked them, what does it help you with? And 70% of the executive told us it increases the commitment to strategy. 69% told us it gives them a much more diverse set of and a larger number of ideas. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I guess, you know, if you frame it on the implementation side, you typically run massive campaigns on the implementation side as well. Now, you bring some of that implementation effort in the creation phase and enrich the creation on top of that. So you probably don't end up spending more than you would usually through, the town hall that you might hold after you decided on a strategy, convince everyone that what you have, you know, crafted is a great idea. And then people just sort of, you know, think, well, you know, it might be a great idea in the boardroom, but out here for me, what do I do with this? Yeah. Some of it might be hidden costs because it doesn't happen in these town halls, but there's, you know, hundreds, thousands of meetings down the line where people try to figure out how they translate all of this. Yeah. Here you put it into the process early. In a way, you go slow to go fast. Yeah. Is yeah. another way to frame it.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I hear from a lot of, and I'm a big advocate of clients taking the time to really think hard before making big announcements and before, you know, progressing and to really do this sort of, let's turn over all the alternatives. Let's really think about what we're doing. And I get so much resistance about, oh, this is going to slow us down. This is going to, like my partner, Ron Boyer, and I have this one client right now that's absolutely determined to proceed to market with this one initiative. And we're basically saying, hang on, here's all these things you haven't really thought of. And they said, oh, we'll figure it out when we get into market. And I'm like, well, no, let's tackle this now while it's still inexpensive and it's small and it's not public. And, you know, if it goes wrong, there's four people that are going to know about it. Let's do all that now. And instead, what they want to do is go public, you know, make a big announcement, get into the market. And so you hear this sort of tension about acting fast and moving. When I'm with you, I think if you took more time up front and got more people involved and got more engagement, you would get so much faster in the overall flow of the program. So there's one particular example.
And sorry if I interrupt once more. There's lots of evidence from academic research that usually things go wrong in the implementation. Different surveys give you different numbers, yeah, but we are talking between 50 to 90% of the reason why it goes wrong is because something doesn't work out in the execution side. And that's, you know, it's less sexy as well, yeah, than I guess the crafting of the idea. So it's easier to think, well, you know, this my ideas are so great, everyone will love it, yeah. But it turns out maybe people don't love it so much, and it would have made sense to think about this earlier.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of my stocks in trade is I talk a lot about corporate flops, you know, the big ones, right? So I have this flops file that I keep in my office. And you have to lose your parent company at least $50 million to get into my flops file. That's the bar. And what we find is the same pattern over and over. Untested assumptions taken as facts, very few opportunities for low commitment testing, all the money, all the funding up front, leaders committed to this, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead kind of approach. And again, not much input from key stakeholders that might be able to point you towards a different example. There was one in the book that I particularly struck me because, you know, with all the conversation we're having right now about environmental responsibility and ESG and this and that, and this is the case of the Gunung Palung National Park and the attempt to address forestry issues.
Yeah.
And I love this idea that you know, after you really analyze it, what you find out is people are cutting down trees because they have no healthcare. Yeah. And I mean, that's the kind of connection that I think we often don't make, which is what is really behind the motivations for people to engage in things that are not environmentally sensible or whatever. And you talk about a remarkable success. So maybe share with our listeners that story.
Yeah, so the NGO world, I guess, you know, is fraught with this. A few Westerners think they have a massive, great idea, and then they bring it somewhere to the developing world. And it turns out to be quite wrong. I spent the last 2 years actually living in Nairobi. So, you know, Nairobi is full with people working from NGOs, and they usually come from the West. Yeah, it's baffling that they don't hire more of the locals. Now, the story we have in our book, it's also an American lady who is sort of at the center of it, but she did, I think, acknowledge that probably the solution has to come bottom up. She spent some time as a student out there in Indonesia and noticed this, you know, problem with deforestation. And then when she was finished with her medical degree, she returned to the country and engaged in something that she recalled radical listening. They talked, if I remember correctly, to 400 locals to find out, you know, why do you need to cut down trees? Yeah, we can assume you don't do it because you're evil. So, you know, what is it that really makes you do so? And as she found out, is for most of the locals, cutting down trees was the only way that they could generate enough funds if there's some medical emergency in the family. And, you know, you can understand then why people do that. Yeah, I mean, if your loved ones are going to die if you don't cut down a tree, I think, you know, you will not hesitate to cut down one of these. So, you know, knowing this, she started to work on the solution. The solution was, again, one that was really sort of, you know, in sync with what the society was doing there. They work very much as a community. Yeah? So they put incentives in place if an entire community does not cut down any trees. Those communities, villages that didn't cut down any trees, they got a 70% discount on medical treatment. On top of this, they could pay for this medical treatment in kind. So they had an organic farming project as well, because one of the other reasons why people are cutting trees is in order to create new farmland. But then after you farm for a few years, the earth is not fertile enough anymore, and you move on and cut trees elsewhere. Organic farming would help you with that, because actually chemical fertilizer is also too expensive for people. So you could pay with manure in order to get your medical treatment. And the manure was used then in the organic farming project of this NGO. Massive success. I can't remember the exact numbers, but somewhere between 60 or 70% drop in illegal logging in this area. Also, you know, other indicators like deaths of young children, health in general, all of that improved as a result of this this initiative. Really impressive. And it's a solution that came from the locals there who understood what their problem was, rather than some smart group of outsiders imposing an idea. And, you know, we all do a bit of consulting, so we're in danger, I guess, in coming with outside ideas. And it's important that there's enough connection and resonance within companies with any ideas, I think, that that we want to introduce there as well.
I love that. And, you know, so often in these, especially in these interventions where outsiders, you know, come in and try to make change happen in other organizations, there are all these unintended consequences. And I think one of the things that your open strategy concept, you know, could be very helpful with is let's find out what some of those unintended consequences could be before we even make a decision, because you've got this much broader variety of perspectives kind of weighing in. So one of the things that you acknowledge in the book is that in strategy, there's always this notion that, you know, if I reveal my strategy, I'll be copied, somebody else will take my idea, you know, I'll get thwarted before I get to come to market. And yet you talk about you allowing secrecy even as you're opening up. So could you elaborate on that tension a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think of strategy in different boxes in a way as well. The idea generation, the formulation phase, and the execution side of strategy. And when you you know, look at this first phase, the idea generation phase, you can involve a lot of people who offer you things that you can work with, but you don't necessarily reveal what you are doing. And the most extreme example we had, well, I'm not revealing first, but the example is from then it kind of loses the punchline. Yeah. So I'll tell you a story and it'll bring us to where it's coming from. Now, there was a little online contest a few years back where people were asked to help with the conservation of buffaloes. You know, people go to national parks in the States throughout the year, and they make these photos of buffaloes and they post them online. As you post them online, there is, you know, some geolocation data behind that could help scientists to then, you know, track where these buffaloes move, and that could help with conservation efforts. The contest was, please provide us with an algorithm that helps us to use this information that people post, and then, you know, it helps us to track movement of buffaloes. We talked to the organizer, and he said, no, massive success. We got what we wanted. We got it much faster, and we got it much cheaper than we would get it if we would hire a company. But it had nothing to do with Buffalo. So the revelation here is this was actually set up by the intelligence community in the United States in the early days of the Crimea war, where they wanted to find an algorithm that helps them to track the movement of Russian troops. Now, you know, if they had revealed that this is what's about, then probably there would have been Russian operatives who could do something here as well. You know, they could offer an algorithm that is winning, but then they understand exactly how the algorithm works. Yeah. Or they could offer an algorithm that looks great, but is somewhat faulty or so. Yeah. So, you know, they could manipulate the process, but they didn't know that. It's an extreme example, but what I'm sort of, you know, trying to say more general is you don't necessarily need to reveal everything that you're doing, and can still get input from people. You know, they get some sort of price over this. In the end, you know, if the CIA can do it, I'm guessing most companies are slightly less secretive than them.
That's so interesting. So an algorithm to track buffaloes actually has a military application. That's fascinating. So when you look at leaders, and I guess I'm thinking at the moment of Meta, you know, / Facebook, and Mark Zuckerberg, who's basically untouchable, right? I mean, he can't be fired. The board can't really tell him what to do. Do you see those kinds of leaders being able to facilitate a process like this? Or would that sort of leadership really say, no, that's not going to happen?
I don't know. You know, I don't necessarily, you know, want to point now at Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh no, I was saying if you took as an example, you know, someone absolutely control over the company.
It would be harder, yeah. But there's a few things that leaders of that kind can do if they would like to be more open. So the first thing I think they can do is they can read a lot. Now, we're both professors, so I guess no one would be surprised that we are fans of reading. But I think it does open your mind, yeah. I'm not sure. Did you see Inside Bill's Brain, this Netflix series about Bill Gates, by any chance? Mm-hmm. If he did, yeah, he carries around the canvas bag full of books all the time. And, you know, people who tell me I don't have enough time to read, well, you know, if Bill Gates finds time to read, probably you can.
I worked with Microsoft for many years under the Gates administration, and he actually crowdsources. He would do these think weeks where he'd take a week off and just go away and do nothing but immerse himself in books. But the books that he read were actually crowdsourced within the company. People would vote on which books they really wanted him to read. And I thought that was so interesting that he actually leveraged the people in the company to shape what his reading agenda would be.
That's fantastic. You know, so in a way, that's a good example of somebody who is an untouchable founder and was still able to listen to others. The other thing, I guess, that always is helpful being connected to the front line. And it's slightly difficult. I acknowledge that because, you know, the leader comes around, everyone tells the leader what they think. Exactly. They get nervous and they tell the leader what the leader wants to hear. So you really sort of, you know, you need to make sure that you build relationships over time where people feel safe, comfortable. You help those who are a bit outspoken and crazy. I mentioned my times in Shell earlier, and my boss at the time when I was doing my PhD there and joined a few projects as well, his name was Robert Bullis. He was second line HR, and he really had this mandate to be a bit crazy. You know, he did stuff that was a bit unusual. So, you know, give some people this, you know, mandate that they can speak truth to you, a little bit almost like the court jest in old days, yeah, where you prepare to listen to them. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you know, that I like is we have this tradition in Austria of big dinner parties that goes back to the 19th century, where people from very different backgrounds come to together in these Viennese circles, and they talk about, you know, philosophy, politics, a variety of different things. But again, it opens your mind. So, you know, if you organize something like this, where you bring people with very different backgrounds into unstructured kind of evening chats, yeah, I think that helps you also to keep more of an open mind.
Well, you and I were both at the Global Peter Drucker Forum. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago?
I was
actually invited to go to Peter Drucker's ancestral home, where he grew the house he grew up in, and I led a salon, and it was exactly that. There were three of us that were the focal people. So it was Ranjay Gulati, who has a new book out on purpose, and a woman named Mary Meany, who's a former super senior person at McKinsey, but who's taken up a calling of helping Ukrainian refugees at her family estate in France. She's got over 100 now Ukrainian refugees, and she's just trying to figure out how to help them get on with their lives. And then I was the moderator, but it was the whole group was really participating in asking questions and talking about, and the particular topic of that evening was the meaning of purpose. But I could see similar salons, you know, kind of serving that function of really opening up your mind. So I think that's
precisely, yeah. And that's exactly what in mind. I think that would be fantastic, yeah.
So just to wrap up on the sort of steps, so sort of toward the end of the book, you talk about step one, open up gradually. Step two, set up new structures and develop capabilities. Step three, amplify external voices. Step four, don't treat open strategy as a fair weather approach, which is interesting, right? Step five, clarify decision rights. Step six, deepen your understanding of open strategy. And then planting the seeds, which I think is a really nice set of constructs. And I mean, I was very impressed with the pragmatism of the book as well, which is, it's not all Pollyanna and there's no such thing as a bad idea. There are more bad ideas than good ones out there in the world, right? And more things that you can not execute than execute well. So I think that's interesting. So where should people go to learn more? How do they become part of your world?
So we have a website, openstrategy.info, and there is on the website, there is a little tool where you can self-assess whether you're ready for open strategy. You know, that might be a nice thing to do that. The other thing that we have on our website, we have created a slide for people who want to teach this, where we have a sort of full slide package, syllabus, for every chapter, we have the package plus descriptions how this can be done, and that could be a nice companion for somebody. You know, if you read the book, there's a sort of chapter, and that gives you a quick overview on how this can be done. That could be a nice way to get started on this.
I love that idea. That's great that you've done all that work. So just to do my little Vanna White thing, the book is open.
You're being so kind, you know. Yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, no, I think, you know, and it really resonated with me, because so much of what I see when people miss, you know, strategic inflection points, or they miss a potential disruption, or they don't pay attention to something that's really vital, is they haven't been listening, right? And somebody always knew, somebody always sees it. And I think it's so important as a strategist to recognize that, you know, you don't have a lock on reality, and you don't have, you know, necessarily access to the whole truth. So it's openstrategy.info, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Openstrategy.info.
Strategy.info, chapter guides, downloadable slideshows. That's amazing. That's a great gift that you're giving. So,
and I think we have my LinkedIn profile. Somebody posted it as well. Yeah, so you can connect me and ask questions directly as well. I'm more than happy to help.
So thank you, and have a great weekend, everyone.